If you're at the beach sometime this summer, it's possible you'll encounter a member or two of the jellyfish family. Jellies are everywhere and seem to be able to thrive even in environments that are extremely challenging for other species. On today's Please Explain, we're going to talk about the beautiful, mysterious jellyfish. And joining us are Steve Bailey, curator of fishes at the New England Aquarium, and Michael Howard, a marine biologist and the senior aquarist for the Monterey Bay Aquarium. Welcome to today's Please Explain.
Good afternoon, Leonard. Thank you for having me.
And I'm to call you Bailey?
Yeah, I pretty much go by Bailey.
Okay, well, we also invite our listeners to leave a comment on our show page, or they can call in at 646-829-3985. Let's begin with you, Michael, because you use your first name. Jellyfish are obviously neither jelly nor fish, so what are they?
The group of animals within phylum Cnidaria that are mostly water and a bit of neurons and sensory organs and whatnot. They just kind of drifting around out in the ocean there.
And they're often described as a form of plankton. I guess that just means that they're free floating.
Correct. They're considered plankton. They are drifters. They do have the ability to swim, but usually not against prevailing currents.
And I've also heard them compared to butterflies in their complexity and as the cockroaches of the sea, ancient and able to survive forever. Are those comparisons useful for our discussion today?
Well, I don't know anything about butterflies other than monarchs come through the peninsula on their migrations. But, perhaps the cockroach analogy is fitting. They seem to be, jellies seem to be able to utilize many, many ecosystems within the ocean.
So, Bailey, what are their basic and defining characteristics? How are sea jellies distinct from all other sea creatures?
Well, as Michael had pointed out, they're essentially water, but they do have some body parts that, if we're talking about the sort of classic jelly, make them easy to identify, and folks can get heads up and heads down, figuratively speaking. Most jellies that folks will encounter while they're out swimming will have a bell-shaped body that, from beneath that bell, will have mouth parts and tentacles. Those mouth parts are sort of frilly, I guess. That's maybe the best way to describe them. The tentacles are thin and long and loaded with nematocysts or stinging cells. Their mouth is centrally located, but it's also where digested food comes out. So it's a one structure, does it all.
Now, you say stinging, but there are also non-sea jellyfish, aren't there, freshwater jellyfish? And they don't sting?
Well, Craspida custa, which is the jelly that you're speaking of, it's believed to have originated in China, and yes, indeed, it does live in fresh water. It seems to be ubiquitous at this point, spread around the globe, and will pop up from time to time, rather intermittently in bodies of water, and generate a lot of interest. Whether or not they have nematocysts, I'm not sure. There are many different types of nematocysts, and not all of them deliver a venom. Some of them are more like sticky cells. So that's a good question. Leonard, I'm not sure whether the freshwater jelly, Craspida custa, is able to sting.
Well, maybe Michael knows. And Michael, I also wonder why they sting in the first place.
Well, I would hazard to guess that at the very least they have organelles called nidi, which is a distinctive characteristic for all animals within that phylum. And I guess the main reason why jellyfish will sting is in prey capture.
So to protect themselves, obviously, but they are captured all the time, aren't they? Aren't they eaten?
Well, many fish. There's over 100 species of fish and a few dozen other groups of animals, you know, turtles and birds, some invertebrates, and jellies also eat other jellies. So, so defense, you know, defensive mechanism for sure, but also I think mainly their own prey capture is their primary purpose.
And you also can, is it jellyfish that you get in a Chinese restaurant that is called jellyfish?
Sure. There are, to my knowledge, maybe at least a dozen countries, you know, primarily in the Pacific, South Pacific, Asian countries that actually have fisheries specifically for jellies. And they tend to be a group of jellies called rhizostomes that have much less potent stinging cells and rely more so on mucus. So I guess they kind of dry them up and prepare them in a way that wouldn't injure any human consumers.
And do they have much nutritional value? I throw out these questions to both of you.
Not much nutritional value at all, actually.
No. In fact, I think it's a lot like eating plastic, squishy plastic. Yeah. I've had them before, and they kind of crackle and pop while you're eating them. And for entertainment value, I'll give it an 8 or a 9, but for nutrition, it's probably a 1 or a 2.
Now,
if I could add something that's very interesting, if you're out in Monterey Bay, you can tell if a leatherback sea turtle has been around, because you'll see scattered at the surface bells of our local sea nettles, because what they do is they come up from below and actually eat the oral arms, which have the highest density of stinging cells, but at the same time, it's the most nutritious part. And so these turtles that grow to be the largest in the ocean are eating just this one portion of it and leaving the bells.
We're talking about jellyfish on today's Please Explain with Michael Howard, a marine biologist and the senior aquarist for the Monterey Bay Aquarium, and Steve Bailey, curator of fishes at the New England Aquarium. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lope. By the way, we have a slideshow of jellyfish available on our show page at WNYC.org. You can also go there to leave a comment if you want to participate in this conversation, or you can give us a call at 646-829-3985. You've been mentioning a whole bunch of different kinds of jellyfish. How many varieties do we know there are? Hello?
I'm here. Yep.
Who wants to field that?
Well, Michael, if you have an exact number, which I know you don't.
There are lots, right? Are there thousands of different kinds?
Both phylums, Cnidaria and Ctenophora, I think we're talking in the range of 1,400.
1,400. Do they appear all over the world, or do they tend to be located in specific areas?
I think they're relatively ubiquitous. You know, certainly individual species have their own distributions, but of all those, you know, that there are in the world, they're pretty much everywhere.
Do they have
new species are being discovered all the time. In fact,
sure.
Michael's down the street neighbors associated with the aquarium at Ambari, the research arm, have discovered some really interesting deep sea jellies. And one of my favorites, because the thing gets so amazingly huge, Big Red, Gran Rojo, I believe, can be almost 3 meters in diameter. And how deep was that, Michael? Was that 1,200 feet when that was seen by the ROV?
I'm not sure exactly, but that sounds like a reasonable estimate.
Well, what would 3 meters be in American speak?
Oh, sorry about that. So the bell on this animal can get to be nearly 10 feet.
Wow.
In diameter. So this is a big jelly.
Do they have brains?
Still 80% water, or 75 or 80% water, but it is a big jelly.
I was asking you, do they have brains or some complex nervous system?
No central nervous system. Basically, generally speaking, you know, there's a few neuron nets and sense organs, that are generally located on the margin of the bell.
They sometimes have eyes, don't they?
Correct. Yeah. Box jellies basically have very sophisticated eyes, which include lens, retina, cornea. So, but you know how they're processing what they. The information they're gathering remains unknown, as far as I know.
So, do we inherit some of that because our eyes have all those things? Are these early developers of eyes?
Good question.
Well, yeah, that one is probably a good example. We can't say this definitively, but a good example of parallel evolution of a structure that is needed. In other words, we aren't related to jellies, but certain jellies have had a need over a couple or more 100 million years to develop an organ that is capable of visualization. Well, the organisms from which we spring have also had that same need. So I guess that's probably the best way to think about it, not knowing the answer precisely.
Well, where do they come from? Who are their ancestors?
Well, the jellies, Michael may have already mentioned this, are related to anemones and corals and crinoids. Some of those animals are known to listeners, but it's a very, very successful group of critters, and in fact, have done a pretty good job of dominating the planet, or not dominating, but have had a very strong presence on the planet until more recently. Their progenitors were, as far as what a common ancestor would be for other other groups of invertebrates, in other words, things unlike us not having a backbone. I'm not sure what to suggest would be a common ancestor, but it's certainly a branch off the tree that has been very, very successful up until now.
Well, let's take a call from one of our listeners along these lines. Chet from Manhattan, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, were you speaking about the dominance of these critters? Well, I heard somewhere that with the increasing acidification of the oceans, that what's going to happen is that they will soon be, maybe not that soon, but they'll be wall-to-wall jellyfish, that all the other critters won't be able to deal with the high acidity, and jellyfish can. So I'll listen to that with interest.
Is that why we're seeing so many more jellyfish these days?
There's not a simple reason. It's, you know, many factors working synergistically. I don't know directly the results of lowered pH on jellies, but certainly we know that it makes a less habitable environment for many of their predators. So in which case they can proliferate more easily.
And how do they reproduce?
How long do we have? There's many different ways, but the basic method is animals are dioecious, so they're separate, male and female. They'll spawn in the water, which will generate what's called a planula, which is basically a ciliated structure that'll kind of swim around and look for a place to settle. At that point, it becomes a polyp, which looks like a teeny sea anemone, and that is also an adult phase, and it can reproduce asexually or undergo what is a transverse fission, and basically called strobilation, and at that point it creates teeny jellies called ephyrae that will grow up to what we see as Medusa.
And
so
they're asexual.
Their reproduction is complex and very strategically laid out. They have the ability to hunker down and wait out conditions that are not amenable to them. They have the ability, as Michael was just describing, to explode in numbers because of this cloning or transverse fission that they engage in. And not all jellies are the same. Some jellies skip stages of that. Some are brooders. They actually haul their young around within them, which sounds very familiar to us vertebrates. There probably isn't any unexplored reproductive route by this this group of organisms.
Because there are so many different ones, we see an awful lot of variety.
In short, yes.
And in some cases, it's still undiscovered. There are many, in particular, many hydrozoan species where the life cycle has not been fully discovered. As Steve mentioned, when conditions are right, they're going to let it loose in huge numbers. And when conditions aren't right, they have the ability to hunker down, as Steve says. But in answering the caller's question, there's other reasons why they're able to tolerate anoxic conditions, places where there's low oxygen. They benefit very well from eutrophic conditions. Fertilizers and whatnot, organics that run off from the land into the sea create inhospitable conditions for most predators of jellies. You combine all those, and you get a good environment for jellies to grow without many predators.
We're going to take a short break and come back with Michael Howard, a marine biologist, senior aquarist for the Monterey Bay Aquarium, and Steve Bailey, curator of fishes at the New England Aquarium, two of the leading aquariums, or do we say aquaria, in this country?
And potato, potato, I think, on that one.
We're going to take some of your calls. Our number is 646-829-3985, or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. You'll also find some pictures of jellyfish on our website. So stay with us. We're back with Steve Bailey, curator of fishes at the New England Aquarium, and Michael Howard, the senior aquarist for the Monterey Bay Aquarium. And we're taking your calls at 646-829-3985. You can also leave comments on our show page at WNYC.org. And let's get to a few of those comments. Lloyd from Manhattan says, I sometimes see coin-sized bits of what appear to be jellyfish on the beach. What would they be? Coin-sized bits of, of just some gelatinous thing?
Steve? Yeah, here in this neck of the woods, presumably he's speaking about the New York Bight, New Jersey, Shore, Long Island, Connecticut. There are some species of salps and salps are not part of the jellies groups that Michael and I have been illustrating thus far. Salps are actually more closely related to us because they have a larval form that almost looks like a fish larva. Here in this part of the U.S., usually in the late summer or early fall, there will be huge numbers of these small oval-shaped gelatinous critters that will come in and carpet the beaches so much so that you can measure them inches thick. So that would be my first guess.
Okay. Let's take a call. We go now to Tony from Brooklyn. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi.
Yes, Tony.
My question would be, I spent a lot of time in the Gulf of Mexico, and I've been in the Gulf of Mexico, and they have Portuguese men of war there, and there's all kinds of ways that they say that you can alleviate the sting from after having been stung. And I would like to know what would work. I mean, I've heard beer works, but beer works for everything.
Well, you mean drinking it or putting it on the sting?
There you go. But at any rate, would the stinging compound be the same in all of them, and would there be a universal cure for it, or to relieve the pain?
And along these lines, another listener asks: Are the jellyfish repellents effective?
Guys? Which part of that do you want to handle, Mike?
I'll just address the first part, I guess, a little bit. What's the treatment that's going to be most effective is going to be dependent on what jelly is stinging you. In some cases, vinegar type solutions work. In most cases, hot water will work. They basically will denature some of the enzymes that are causing the irritation.
Neither of those describe beer.
No, but yeah, so beer won't be a local topical remedy, but that might help systemically. But as far as specifically for Portuguese man of war, I don't know off the top of my head. Maybe Bailey knows.
We do not have anything that is specifically recommended on our website, and we try to maintain some of these remedies as there's so much curiosity about it during the summer with many people being beachgoers. Michael's already mentioned vinegar, the hot water. Often you're on a beach, and who's carrying vinegar with them? Over the years, and I can't personally vouch for this, but over the years there have been claims that that human urine works reasonably well at ameliorating or mitigating the sting after the jelly venom has been fired into your skin.
So now we're back to the beer.
Maybe the urine first, then the beer, as Michael was suggesting.
Okay. What about the repellents? Do any of them work?
I don't have any direct experience.
There's no DEET for jellyfish.
Well, repellents could be divided up into a number of categories. The Australian beach patrols have a repellent in that they are rather attractively clad in full pantyhose and only just their heads exposed, and they manage to swim out to rescue someone or be in the water with a lot of jellies around and not be stung, because that layer of very thin material is sufficient so that the nematocyst, the stinging cell from the jelly tentacle, cannot make contact with the sting. So that repellent indeed works. But chemical repellents, I have not heard of a chemical repellent that anyone has scientifically tested and is recommending for beachgoers to buy.
A listener asked, do jellyfish travel in schools like fish? They have blooms, don't they? Is that the same thing?
Well,
not exactly.
Schools. I guess I would. There's a good factoid here. Jellies or groups of jellies are called smacks, SMAKS, smacks, smacks of jellies. The bloom. Michael was alluding to this earlier. We will probably be seeing a great deal of coverage on this summer. The dead zone, as it has been called, down in the Gulf of Mexico, at the mouth of the Mississippi offshore, and can become quite large. In fact, one year I believe it was the size of the state of Rhode Island, will be quite large this year because of the floods, the terrific amount of rain and the subsequent floods in the Midwest. All of that fresh water is runoff from farmland and is headed straight to the Gulf of Mexico. Jellies will do quite well in those environments, those low oxygen environments that Mike was describing. And there will be what the media will call blooms of jellies, huge numbers of jellies that are doing quite well and not being preyed upon by their predators.
Rob in New Jersey says, last weekend in the ocean off Belmar, New Jersey, there were a million, if not billions, of pea-sized clear jellyfish. Were these eggs or young jellyfish or pieces of jellyfish? Some had small dark specks inside. Others were perfectly clear.
What do you think, Michael? Tinafores?
Boy, it could... It, it, you know, it's just hard to say, but it could be tenophores. Many hydrozoans don't get more than a few millimeters in size. It could be any number of things, or it could have just been that. It could be fish eggs or bits of jellies. Hard to say.
And without a picture, anyway. And we have a lot of questions along these lines. Alan from Cape Cod writes, on a beach that borders both the Atlantic and Nantucket Sound, there were thousands of one-half-inch bubbles of jellyfish-like material, very beautiful. They did not have tentacles nor sting in their whole state, but one of us received a severe sting from an unknown substance high on the beach. What might these bubbles have been?
Well, again, as Michael has said, it could be anything, but this time of the year, late spring into early summer, we will see here in New England a large number of different types of tenophores. This is another group of jelly that has rows of cilia on its external surface that help push it through the water. So these hair-like structures have it locomote that way, as opposed to their bell pulsing. I think that's the way most folks think of jellies moving through the water, as a pulsing bell. So it's possible that it was a species of tenophore. Lytes comb jelly can be present in huge numbers, or an animal that has the common name of sea walnut, Pleurobrachia, can often be present in huge numbers at this time of the year. Just really tough to say without a photo.
Marion, yeah. In Chinatown. Okay, go ahead.
I would just recommend to all the listeners that go to the beach and want to know, if you can carefully scoop it up into a dish of water, a glass of water, so it'll be in its, you know, to be in the water, and take a picture and send that to your local aquarium, or there's some citizen science groups out there that are interested in all sorts of these types of sightings, and you might be able to have a better luck with identification.
Let's take another call. This is from, Zinnia from the Bronx. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, yes, I understand jellies are really ancient animals. Could you talk a little bit about that compared with our human existence and other animals, maybe?
Do they predate the dinosaurs?
By a long shot.
Steve? Yeah.
By a long shot. Jellies don't make the best fossils, because when you're essentially trying to get an impression of
water.
Water, yes. A couple of terms are coming to mind there that probably weren't appropriate, but yes, it's very difficult to get much information from the fossil record, but the guesses are well beyond 400 million years ago. So dinosaurs were barely a twinkle in their progenitors' eyes when jellies were roaming the planet, at least initially.
Okay, well, thank you for your call. We've got a number of calls from listeners who ask about meat tenderizer as a sting treatment. Would that work?
Do you want to tackle that one, Michael?
I'm not sure. What's in the meat tenderizer? I guess that's depends on what the ingredient is.
Well, isn't meat tenderizer the same thing that people complain about in Chinese food?
Well, no. My understanding is meat tenderizers are primarily shaker bottles full of enzymes.
Mm-hmm.
So what makes a piece of meat less tough when you're sprinkling a meat tenderizer on it is enzymes are attacking those proteins that make up that steak. So a jelly venom is essentially a protein waiting for it to be changed, its configuration to be changed, so it's not so potent, at least from our perspective. We want that molecule to be changed into something different. So meat tenderizer, yeah, that's probably a pretty good approach, but once again, meat tenderizer isn't something that a lot of folks are carrying on the beach with them.
Now, both
they plan a barbecue afterward.
Haven't both of your aquariums had exhibits involving jellyfish?
Yes,
definitely.
In fact, I'm going to tout Monterey's really industry-leading endeavors on displaying jellies. We learned from Monterey. Monterey's early exhibits were just spectacular and impressed everybody in the public aquarium industry. And we here in Boston decided that we needed to do the same. And the folks at Monterey were very gracious and helped train us and get us started. And we've never looked back. Jellies are some of the most popular exhibits. Exhibit choices that any public aquarium can make.
And Michael, don't you also raise them?
Correct. Yeah.
So how do you raise a jellyfish?
Well, you have to first understand their life cycle, and as I was mentioning before, you need to get their polyp phase, and this is absolutely necessary because jellies in the wild are distributed in a patchy manner. They are often seasonal. They usually don't live very long. So you need to be raising them in a laboratory setting in order to ensure a year-long display. So there's many ways to get polyps. You know, rarely you can maybe find them diving, but then you bring it back and you have to identify it. But really the best ways are through in vitro fertilization. So, for example, with
you got to make it quick.
Okay, you can snip gonads and put them in a dish, and then the sperm and egg come out and initiate it that way. Or if their jellies are small, you can put them in a dish and they'll spawn and you go from there.
We have a beautiful slideshow on our page. My great thanks to Steve Bailey and Michael Howard for being on today's Please Explain.
Thank you very much.
Our pleasure. Thank you, Leonard.